This is our semi-annual, or every other year, I think, Neighborhood University, and we're going to be devoting it to the topic of transportation concurrency. So how many of you are familiar with that and spend a lot of time talking about it over the table, breakfast table? Yeah. So,
those are two different questions.
All right, that's true. Our transportation commissioners are very, very familiar with this. So it's our opportunity to tell you about how that works here in Kirkland, and we have assembled a wonderful panel here to talk to you about it. So our two first speakers, the first is Mark Hollenbeck, the gentleman in the Sounders uniform. and he is the director of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. And we're so thrilled to have him. He came and did a phenomenal job for us at our Alternative and Advanced Transportation Forum that we had back in February. And we're so impressed we wanted to have him come back again. So, Mark, thank you so much for being here. He also teaches urban planning and intelligent transportation systems. And he is going to be talking about the Growth Management Act and how it relates to growth and transportation and concurrency. And sitting next to him is David Godfrey, who is our transportation engineering manager for the city of Kirkland. He also has the awesome job of being the project manager for the Cross Kirkland Corridor, as well as the transportation master plan. So he is going to be talking about Kirkland's approach to transportation planning and how we are now looking at a new way of doing concurrency, which is being led by our Transportation Commission. And then following Mark and Dave's presentation, we're going to have audience question and answer, and we're going to have a comment period with a panel of experts beyond Dave and Mark. And so if you could stand up, please. We have Don Sundahl here, who's with the firm of Fair and Pierce and is working with us on our master plan. He's the consultant leading that effort, as well as the Winnetka Corridor Study and the transportation element of our comprehensive plan. So key player for us here. And then Sandeep Singhal is here. He is the chair of the city's Transportation Commission. And Eric Shields was going to be our third panelist, but he's unfortunately a little under the weather today, even though it is beautiful weather. So his deputy director, Paul Stewart, is going to fill in for him. And so thank you, Paul, for stepping in. And so they'll be here to answer your questions after the presentation. A couple quick things before we launch. I do want to let folks know that we are taping this. We've done that with all of our Neighborhood University, so that people who can't be here can watch it. So please be advised that both audio and visual, we're taping this. And then I think you saw the council members are here. Dave Asher will be joining us in a second. And then if any other members come in, we will introduce them as well. And then also finally, Penny Mabee has been our amazing facilitator and consultant on the whole Kirkland 2035 outreach process. She is going to be your MC and coming out and handing you the microphone to ask your questions. So I'll be handing this back over to her. So with that, welcome. We're thrilled to have you. We can't wait for your questions and your insights on a topic that probably deserves a lot more discussion than it usually gets. So welcome and thanks for coming.
Thanks, Kurt. Thanks, everybody. Glad to have you here. Why don't we go ahead and get just right started away with Mark going first?
And I think I'm live. Yep, I can hear that. So hi, I'm Mark, and they asked me to talk about concurrency. So let's start with growth management. So the Growth Management Act is really the legislative outcome of a desire from an awful lot of people to ensure that as population grows, the services necessary to meet the needs of those people are actually present. So three things get covered really under concurrency: water, sewer, and transportation. The first two are really easy. Do you have a water source? If you can plug into a municipal water service and you have water, life is good. If you can dig a well and get water and not mess up your neighbors, life is good. Off you go. Sewer, same thing. If you can plug into a municipal sewer system and they have capacity, life is good. If you can build your own minor sewer system, and I've just drawn a blank on that, even though septic tank, I knew that. Wow, it's Saturday, sorry. If you can put in a septic field and life is good, off you go. Transportation, that's much tougher. Adequate transportation. So transportation, we said, okay, we should have something. Transportation concurrency, if a city, a county, puts together a plan and we feel we have adequate transportation, you may proceed with your development. You may get a permit and off you go. So this assumes that, in fact, at some point, there will be enough transportation. If there isn't, the assumption in the transportation concurrency regulations are that something will happen and more transportation will appear, and you will then be permitted to go. It's not designed to prevent development from happening. It's intended to delay development until the services necessary are there. Interestingly, because my definition of adequate transportation can be different than your definition of adequate transportation, because I'm right and you're wrong, but we'll get there later. Every city is allowed to define adequate differently. And this is realistically perfectly fine, because what's adequate for some areas might not be adequate for other areas. Realistically, some people will say, congestion, bring it on, we like the development. Others can say, I had to slow down today, bad. Actually, this is like 1988. I would bet Don was there. There was an ITE State Transportation Conference. It was in Yakima. It started at 8 o'clock in the morning. I drove over the night before, stayed in the Holiday Inn, got up, was eating breakfast in the Holiday Inn, and people were complaining about the awful traffic congestion getting into Yakima. And I was sitting there thinking, what, you hit the light on the way in? But to them, it really mattered. They were quite upset. I grew up in LA, right? In the 70s, I was down in Irvine, and you know, people were complaining about traffic in Seattle, and I was visiting, I was at a conference in Irvine and headed back to my folks' house. They still live in Southern California. I was sitting on an 8-lane arterial that was dead stopped in both directions over top of the 405 down there, which at that point was, I think it's 6 lanes in each direction, dead stopped in both directions. And I'm thinking, they're complaining about traffic in Seattle? Traffic is very definitely an issue. And yet, it's not necessarily what everyone wants for adequate transportation. Can I get around? On the other hand, traffic is something, in many respects, that we as cities feel we have control over. We can build roads. Right? Sometimes we don't control transit. Voters turn down transit regulations and service goes away, in which case I don't have so much control over that. So if I control what roads exist and how they operate by adding lights or changing signals or adding turning lanes, roads are a good thing. So look, most jurisdictions responded and said, concurrency is all about roads, and we'll develop a mechanism to say, do we have enough roads? Do we need to build more roads? Do we add widened lanes? Do we have to add in intersections or whatever? Right. Until we went to use it. When we went to use it, one of the things we found was that roads, purely roads as a measure, is a really blunt instrument. Now, the way concurrency works is you set your system, your regulation, and if you fail the regulation, you are not allowed to permit new development. Period. End of story. Until your equation shows that life is okay, and now you can permit it. And what that means is, if your equation is all about roads and you fail, the only way to solve it is to add roads. And if you get to a place like Kirkland, and you look around the beautiful downtown and say, okay, I'm going to add a lane. You don't need sidewalks. Why would anybody walk? Cars, we drive. All drive-in restaurants now. And that puts you in a place where I'd really like to rebuild this town. You know, here's an old building, it's falling apart. I'm not allowed to permit it, okay, because this road is too congested. So I have to knock those buildings down and widen this road, and then I can, that doesn't make any sense. But that's the way the regulation was written. Okay? So if your entire measure is about roadway level of service, all your solutions are about roads, even if that doesn't work. Another interesting aspect of this is that it's not my problem, it's your problem solution, which is typical of all politics. One of the things we quickly found out about the ability for Kirkland to have my system and Redmond to have their system and Bellevue to have their system and Issaquah to have their system is, if I don't mind the congestion, it's not my problem, it's your problem. And I can generate all kinds of traffic, and as long as it's okay on my roads, as soon as it gets to your roads, it's your problem, not my problem. This, by the way, came back to bite Issaquah really badly. They had a great system. They said, look, we're okay with things as it is, but you can't build anything that makes it worse for everybody else. Perfectly fair. Sounds great. Except they didn't consider that they'd already permitted a bunch of stuff that was building, and so that stuff happened, and suddenly things were worse. Okay? Through no fault of anybody's. And then they said, oh, sorry, regulation says you can't build stuff. So they had things like dance studios that couldn't rebuild themselves. You know, not growing into, they just couldn't actually change because they couldn't get the permit by law. So what happened? Well, if you couldn't build in Issaquah, you built in North Bend. You built in Maple Valley. And what does that mean? It means you drive through Issaquah. Right? So they got even worse traffic. And no development, and no money to do anything. Because they couldn't permit it. So everybody moved out, and they got way worse. Unintended consequences. But North Bend didn't care. It's not my problem. Have some cars. Life's good. So these regional problems, and by the way, by definition, state highways of significance don't count. Again, perfectly logical from a regulation standpoint. Because 405 sucks, right? And you guys don't have a couple billion dollars sitting around to make 405 work. And you wouldn't want the fact that 405 sucks to keep Kirkland from doing what Kirkland needs to do. You can't rebuild Totem Lake because 405 sucks. Okay, so we take that out. Oh, so what happens? Okay, except when 405 is a mess, right? Everything backs up into Kirkland, which messes up your roads, which means you fail. Huff. So, you have some interesting problems with this. So the concurrency system about road, dang, I forgot to turn my watch on. I'm good. That's what you think. So, concurrency based on roads works really well when the problem and the solutions are roads. Rural areas, the far exurban areas, you want to build farther out in Monroe, roads aren't really a problem. Okay, that's a good system. When you get to areas where roads aren't the only solution, a system that is only about roads doesn't work. Some statistics. Everybody likes statistics on a Saturday morning. On the right side of this, the big red 85 says, if you live somewhere outside of the major centers of this metropolitan region, and this is over 10 years ago, 85% of you get to work by driving your car, by yourself. And another 10%, so 95%, 10% extra in carpools and vanpools. 95% of you get to and from work by car in those areas. On the other hand, in centers, Bellevue, Redmond, Canton, Seattle, 25% of the people take transit. 26% walk. By the way, Seattle is one of the leading walking areas right now, and Kirkland, downtown Kirkland, is growing. And how many people walk to work or bike to work? So, in this area, a road-based system might be a really good idea. In these areas, doesn't get you necessarily what the people who live and work here want. And by the way, Kirkland is growing in this area. Traffic. Cars just get more and more. Well, this is another statistic. This is a graph of vehicle miles traveled, and this is about 2000. It starts to flatten out. Matter of fact, it's going down, and the question is whether it will continue to go down. There are lots of really interesting statistics behind this, and this is, you don't have to read this. Every PowerPoint slide presentation has to have a slide you cannot read, and this is mine. Okay, they won't let you do this. It's, you know, part of the code. So this is, the green part is when this line was going up. All these things were happening. We had more and more people. All the women, shame on you women, joined the workforce. And of course, you had to get there, and so you drove. And so we bought second cars, and we had more income. And when you have two cars and two people working, and suddenly you drive more. That's great, except now you're all working. And we already own two cars. At one point, I owned four cars. All right? And when you look at how these things are happening, all of a sudden, a lot of the trends that were driving people to drive more and more have stopped. So, will it continue? I don't know. This is, if you ever get to take my urban transportation planning class, which is a hoot, because it takes a bunch of civil engineers and whacks them upside the head and says it's not about the engineering. If I used to give, a class project was easy. I give it out, groups of five, great. Your problem is fix 520. Oh, yeah, by the way, you have to find the money. You have to get the politics. You have to understand the institutions. You have to describe all the problems. And I used to do what's called, I called, this is before the term existed, speed dating for traffic engineers. So I would bring people like Don in and say, Don, come, I need you for an afternoon. You get to play an interest group. What interest group would you like to be? And Don would think, who do I hate the most? What has been driving me nuts on the Lace Pride? Okay, I'm going to be the Indian tribes. Okay? So I would get my professional friends to come play an interest group. And I'd say, great, you guys, my teams, you have your whole list of alternatives. You got 5 minutes with interest groups to get public input into your project so you can select things. Every 5 minutes, speed dating, you're going to change interest groups. Okay? Got 2 hours? Go! If you saw in the beginning, there were these bright young students ready to go, had this list, they were going to solve the problem. If you got them at the end, you were the last person, regardless of what you were doing. They were down to one alternative. They had already come to the conclusion that you, even not, you had not talked to you yet, that you would hate that alternative. And they would come back to, oh, Professor, we're going to die. I said, no, let's do it. Congratulations, you passed the class. By the way, you got a report due in 2 weeks. What's your answer? Welcome to transportation planning. If you are the Indian tribes, 520 is all about fisheries, right? Because their spirit, their livelihood revolves around the ability to get fish through the Motlike Cut. And you're going to mess that up? Heck with you. You commute across 520. It's all about the road. Come on, 8 lanes, of course. You're an anti-tax person. Heck no. Yeah, sure, you can build whatever you want. Toll it completely. Don't charge me. I don't use 520. You're a bike rider. Whatever, I don't care what you do, so there'd be a bike lane. I'm a train aficionado. It's great, but there's got to be a train. And so your district comes down, right to Monroe, because of where I live. The answer to all urban transportation planning questions is it depends. It depends on what your perspective is. You have to understand how other people view things, because they view them, rightly so, very differently. I call this the famous greed slide. I didn't invent it, but I love it. The same amount of density is up here and down here. Same number of single-family houses, multifamily houses. They both have a shopping center. They both have a school. Great. The transportation in these two neighborhoods is completely different. In this neighborhood, Harris, Sally, she's 10. She wants, maybe 8. She wants to go play at Joe's house. How does she get there? Well, this all has nice fences in the backyard because it keeps the dog in. Right? And so Sally has to go this way, out onto the major road. Right? Think 85th. So, of course, Sally's going to walk there. Heck no! Mom or Dad drives Sally to Joe's house. Sally has to go to Joe's house. He walks. If this road is big, she goes this way. You talk to these people and say, transit. They say, great, where's the park and ride? Because no bus can go up here, come back here, go up here, come back here, and have any level of service that makes any sense for a rational human being. You say bus, you put on a bus here, and all these people can walk to it. So this bus is efficient, it's quick, and lots of people can get to it. So they use it. Makes perfectly good sense. In this neighborhood, this road is guaranteed to be congested as soon as this is built. Why? Because all of these people have to turn left at some point off of this road. And so there are lights all along it. And, as any good traffic engineer will say, you can't progress traffic in two directions on a road simultaneously. Doesn't work mathematically. So with all those lights, you get traffic congestion. Guaranteed. So these people all complain about this road. It should be widened so I can get in and get out. These people who live next to it fight like crazy because they're the ones who pay for it. In noise, in pollution, in dangerous things happening to their cats and dogs. So why do people live in these beautiful places? Because you can play baseball in the street here, and soccer, and it's quiet. Except because everyone back here now parks their car in their garage, these people drive through at 45 miles an hour because they don't realize how fast they're going. Why not? Because our visual clues, our auditory clues that tell you how fast you're going, don't exist. When I first got my first car, brand new 1975 Ford Fiesta, great little car. No sound deadening, no nothing. If I went 60 miles an hour in that car, it was happy to go 60. You went down the car like that, right? And you knew you went 60. So when I was on freeways, I went 65, right? I knew. I would get in my father's brand new Thunderbird, one of the last giant Thunderbirds. Roll up the windows, you didn't hear anything. Right? Great sound. Drove like a boat. Big suspension. You turned it on, you went 80. Same person. Right? All based on what physically you hear. The insights you get here, the visual clues, the auditory clues, the social clues you get here are different than here. And they affect what you want. Concurrency, the system, is about getting what you want. What Kirkland wants is out there. You guys have to go and tell these people, yeah, we like this, realizing that change is going to happen. And because change is going to happen one way or another, your goal here is to help come up with something that is good for everyone. Then the concurrency system can help you get there. Now, these guys are changing their concurrency system away from roads. They're changing it to a plan-based system, which is pretty cool. It's a great idea. The idea is that, one, no plan is perfect. It does it for you, because if it's all about you, everybody else is going to hate it. So what are you going to give in order to get? Think about that as you talk through these things. Second, what you want from a transportation perspective is something that's safe, efficient, and has options. Because other people are going to want to get around in ways that are good, convenient, safe for them, as well as you. What those options are up to you. Another thing, think sharing. Sharing is good. Now, this is just a fascinating thing. I use your library parking lot all the time. It is one of the best parking lots in the history of parking lots. Because in a place where land is expensive, it's expensive here. I tried to buy a house in Kirkland, all right? Where land is expensive, you want to use it wisely. This parking lot gets used 20 hours a day, 6.5 days a week. And if there was a church here, it would be 7 days a week. It's used for many different things. It's used for the library. It's used for the baseball game that's going on right now. It's used as downtown overflow parking for restaurants in Kirkland. I come here all the time and park there. It's used for the performing arts. It's used for the swimming pool. It's a great utilization. Sharing is good. Sharing of road space is good. Sharing of parks is good. Sharing of parking is good. Okay? So, when you look out there, think, is this mix of land use and transportation right for Kirkland that shares amongst all of us? Realizing that it is not meant to be perfect to you. It is meant to give you opportunities. Opportunities to play, opportunities to work, opportunities to shop, and opportunities to get there and to get out quickly, efficiently, not perfectly. You do not get to drive 60 miles an hour into the parking space that is yours. If it happens that way, if you see what you want, it works, then you'll have a good plan. The new concurrency system is plan-based. It says this is what we want, this is how we're going to get there. Everybody who participates contributes in this way, and we go forward. If that's the process, you'll have a really good outcome. It takes away a little bit of the mathematical concurrency approach to roads and goes elsewhere. I think that's a pretty good change. Do you believe it can happen? This is the University of Washington's Montlake parking lot. This picture was taken when I was a student. If you didn't get there by 9, you parked, this was at the time the quarter lot. If you didn't get that, you were in the dime lot, which was on the other side of the little slough. And if you weren't there, you were all the way up by past the driving range out to the old baseball field, the nickel lot. And they filled up. This is the Montlake lot now. This is empty. And they have actually rented off the entire south end of it to Children's Hospital because they don't use it. The reason is they have a whole system. They charge for parking. The prices went up. They took that. They added bus service. They added a whole bunch of bike lockers. They added a whole lot of other things. And they don't have a parking problem. And, of course, there are about 50% more people on campus than when the first slide was taken. It's an easy place to get to. Easy place to get out of. What's Kirkland going to look like? Yours.
So that may be the first time we've had like a real professor teach Neighborhood U. And that was good. And so now you're going to hear from a, what's the lowest thing, an adjunct instructor, or adjunct lecturer or something? Yeah. Teaching assistant, right. What do you call the green slide again? Is it the fabulous green, the famous green slide? So I'm going to take a map of a 10-minute, it's this thing project we're working on called 10-Minute Neighborhoods, and I'm going to bring it downstairs, and you're all going to come downstairs after this is over, I bet. And I'd like you to take a look at that and think about the fabulous, the famous green slide.
It works either way. It's not my slide anyway.
Because, yeah, all right. So because you can find out ways to make those neighborhoods better. And thanks. What did you, Merritt, did you like the Ford vehicle plug? Was good, wasn't it?
Did you hear that?
Yeah, it was great. Okay, great.
It was a great car.
And
I know.
It still is. Yeah, and it depends is so true because I didn't know the Peter Kirk parking garage was really great. I thought it was dark, smelled funny, and didn't have the right signs. But I'm glad to hear that everybody's perspective is different. Okay, good. So, and let's see. In a few weeks, I'll be celebrating 30 years as a traffic engineer. And I think I got slapped up in the head about 25 years ago and realized it's not about engineering. So thank you for that. All right. Okay, so here we go. I'm just going to fill in a few details, really, because that was excellent. I mean, that was fabulous and really covered everything I'm going to say. But I'm just going to tell you a couple of slides about our master plan, which you can find out more about downstairs. But we really have two parts to it, the orange part, which is the policies and goals of the which really the transportation element of the comprehensive plan, and then we have the green side, which is going to add and amplify on that and give some more action than you'd see in a normal comprehensive plan. And that becomes the blue transportation master plan. And then an important part of that is our 20-year project list. And it sounds like I'm constantly plugging going downstairs after this. I am. And so you can learn more about that downstairs and help make some decisions about that. Just another quick overview on the transportation master plan. We have some goals. Then it's like, okay, what's the land use? We'll talk about that in a minute. What kind of, we're calling them projects, but what kind of transportation facilities are going to go along with that? And then we have to decide, as you so eloquently said, what's good enough for us? And it kind of matters how much money we have in the end. So those are the goals. Hey, we need to do all kinds of modes. And I'm glad Paul is here because the land use side and planning is really integral. We need to be sustainable. That's fiscally sustainable, environmentally sustainable. We need to be an active partner because DOT plays, among other agencies, Metro plays a big role, private sector. And then we need to try to measure what we do. All right, so I'm just going to fill in a couple blanks here about what's our current system. And Mark did a great job of explaining how this works. And it's kind of the old style where you have it Saturday morning, so we have cartoons. And plus, this, I think this is so dry that it's fun if it's cuter. Don't you think that? So if we have a given amount of land use, and then we decide what road projects we can afford and accept. So maybe we're not going to widen 108th Avenue, but we might do some intersection projects around Totem Lake, for example. That equals, put those two things together, and you get some performance. And this Mr. Clock here is kind of showing like how fast you travel. He's kind of a stand-in for how fast you can get places. So, and the way we're keeping score is just at signalized intersections. So it's performance at intersections, plus we have this funny thing called 1.4 maximum, which means think of it as a glass and water. And so we're kind of like how big the intersection is would be the glass, and how much traffic is like the water. And we're saying it's okay if you have 40% more water than you do glass. But I'll talk about that in a second. But hey, and that brings us to this point, which is, well, all right, yes, but that's kind of the agreement we came to, because otherwise, if we said, no, you can only fill up the glass, you know, you can only fill it up 80% because we want to have a nice empty spot, then we'd have to make this huge or not do this. And so we kind of coordinated it to be this way. But this is how we keep scoring. Sort of, this is what happens. We have a development that comes in, and we say, how many trips are you generating? And we add that with how many, what kind of development has already been approved but not yet built, plus what we can count, right? And we add all that up and do all this magic stuff and come up with left, through, and right turning volumes at each intersection. And then here's your water and your cup. And we divide this city into four pieces, and we calculate it at each intersection. And if the average is good enough and everything's under 1.4, then you're okay. That's how you pass concurrency. So that's an example of a kind of mathematical, more complicated system. That was the old way of doing it. And what we're thinking about for our new system is still have land use, but this time you have more like multimodal projects. So up here we kind of show like cars and bikes and peds. For example, transit's in there somewhere. So this, again, we have to decide, like, what's good enough, what range, what do we want to have in each group, and then out comes our concurrency. And these two things kind of have to be in balance. Now, you'll notice the teeter-totter isn't exactly parallel, so it doesn't mean it has to precisely match, but it's got to be pretty close. Nobody can be, you know, on the ground or way up in the air. It's got to be sort of similar. And so I want to talk about how this is built a little bit. Land use decisions are going to be over here in blue. So I guess the corollary to your thing about something you have to have one you can't read, has one that's a little confusing. If they haven't been already, here's one for you. So this one's a little bit confusing, but I hope you can read it. So we've got a certain amount of land use today. Let's say it's, just call it 20,000 trips. And we know, Paul tells us, hey, here's what the land use is going to be. It's putting a lot on him. It's probably not exactly that way. And then we figure out, like, how many trips are coming from that. So, like, we have 20,000 today. There's 30,500 in the future. Those numbers are kind of made up for right now. And that means we have to account for this many trips, right? So that's on the land use side. And on the transportation network side, we've got come up with a 20-year project list. Remember that? And we have about $260 million, if you look at today's dollar, kind of the spending we have today. Take out $100 million for maintenance. We're assuming that they don't provide capacity. And you're left with like $160 million that have to support growth. So you have about $160 million of projects over 20 years that need to account for that much. And so this is where we have to do the decision making of like what's good enough. So you have to go downstairs and help us figure out like what is this, what should this list look like? What should be on there? What's going to be good enough? And we have a little exercise where you can actually get your $160 million bucks and some other money too, and you go and you put around like how much in parks, how much for transportation, within transportation, how much for walking, how much for biking, how much for cars. So go downstairs and you can do that little exercise, and that's kind of a model of making sure this is right. And once that's right, then it's down to like, okay, so I got this many trips over 20 years. So how much do I have in 6 years? Okay, somebody remember this, 3150. And, you know, you divide this, you get 26.6 million. So I've got this many projects over 6 years. I got this many trips over 6 years. I can then kind of put those two together and say they're equal. And there I go. So I got 3150. And then to keep score, as opposed to that other more confusing or mathematical method that had the glass of water and the all that magic going on to figure out what the trips were at the intersections, you just take the development being tested, you look up the number of trips it makes, and you compare it to a ledger. It's kind of like a checkbook. So it's easy enough to find for different kind of land uses. People have figured out about like per unit of development how many trips you get. So if you're building a 1,000-square-foot restaurant, which would be pretty small, I think, you'd only generate 7.5 trips. And then over here's how we'd keep track, right? We'd start with, remember that 3150? So you'd start in January with 3150. A development comes in of 124 trips. You subtract. You've got this much balance. Yes, it's positive, so you're good. And you work your way down. Pretty easy to understand as opposed to the other system that I talked about earlier. See, there's that 3150. Okay. So getting to the end here. I'm looking forward to the comments and questions. The existing system is pretty much intersection-based because that's how we're keeping score. So, like Mark said, that's how you keep score, that's what you do. We had the four sub-areas. This is a little more citywide. This is autofocus. This is other modes. Hard to understand. Easy to understand. Many moving parts. Fewer moving parts. And I think the bottom one is really important because right now it's difficult for folks who are interested in watching how development works or folks who are interested in doing development or the city council or staff to exactly know, like, where are we and how much space do we have and so on. And under this proposed system, it seems like that would be clearer. I guess this proposed system is something also that Redmond is looking at and or is doing right now, and that's kind of where we got the model from, and I think... Don, is it right? The Bellevue sort of looking at something like this, too. And I think, Mark, would you agree with me that one of the other principles is, you know, how you measure concurrency is great, but what really matters is where you set what's good enough? Yep. You can measure, like, the number of red cars, right? But the thing is, like, how many are you going to allow? So that's where it gets. That's where you have to get to that double arrow across the red and blue columns and say what's good enough. Okay, and I want you to know that we've been thinking about the future, and this is a self-driving electric car, and I think it's a fun picture. All right, so this is your invitation to go downstairs after our session is over, but at this point, I want to turn it over to Penny, right?
Yeah.
And we'll invite our other panelists up.
Exactly. Why don't we
we'll
have
share
our
these two
four panelists come on up to the front here. Let's pull these chairs across the front.
All right.
So we can see better. Interesting stuff, right? Did you learn something? So I'm curious about something. I'm going to give you a chance here to just ask some open questions, but I'm going to pose a question for you to think about. What did you hear from these two gentlemen who are mostly entertaining, but very informational as well? What did you hear that kind of got you thinking, said, this gives me a different thought? Something come to mind when you heard them talk about this? Nothing came to mind.
It's Holy Saturday smokes. Morning.
I know. It is still Saturday morning, huh? Right. Okay, all right. Did it bring up a question? Something you don't understand? Ah, here we go. Okay, I'm going to bring the mic around because this is being taped, so we want to make sure everybody can hear. So in the interest of making sure we get to as many questions as we can, let's try and be as succinct as possible. And start here. I'm not letting go of
the mic. Oh, okay. Got a good idea. I'm glad I don't have to remember the 1.4 anymore, but I am curious about how the city articulates what is good enough. You've got a new system for measuring success or failure, but how do you define, in a way the public can understand, what's good enough?
Oh, sorry, I'm going to try and back up here, because I don't know the number. we will have a list of projects that we'll start with here, and that will be the projects that we build, and that'll be good enough. All right, so, but I think your question is, well, I know, but, like, would that mean that I'll have a sidewalk on every street, every busy street, or just some of them, or will all the school walk routes have sidewalks, or, and so that's, downstairs, we have some thoughts about that. So we have some packages of how, and how much they cost and a little bit about what you get in each one of those. So you need to kind of have a feel for, if I spent $20 million bucks over 20 years on sidewalks, what would that get me? And we've done some thinking about that. And, of course, you can move things around. And if I spent $60 million on auto improvements, what would that feel like? Well, we don't have it exactly quantified, like it will be this much. But I think we would say, in any event, we're going to continue to have congestion for autos on at peak times on most days in Kirkland. But does it mean, did that kind of get what you're asking at?
Okay, I've got to go right over here, Dave.
How do you determine what your cost basis would be to meet concurrency when some of the transportation modes that are on the agenda are off budget?
I think you're, do you want me to answer that one? I think you're talking about, like, when you say off budget, you mean like maybe Metro Transit or something like that, or?
You have no idea what their costs are, and yet they're being built.
Let me. Yeah, good.
Yeah, sure. How many lanes are on 520 being proposed?
Six. Yeah.
If you would say six, you would be wrong. There is seven lanes, and the seventh lane is larger than the lane that holds the buses and the trucks.
So you're talking about the bike
facility. And the Department of Transportation, through numerous correspondence, has no idea what they're spending on that seventh lane. So how do you establish a transportation concurrency when some of the transportation module systems are completely off budget?
So there are a couple ways I would guess I would respond to that. The first is, one of the great things about concurrency is you can always change the rules, right? That's, as a matter of fact, what you're doing right now. And the way you change the rules is you have an open process and say, it's 5 years from now, and we're going to change the rules. We're going to update our transportation plan. We're going to update our concurrency plan. The things that we had presumed that were going to happen, and amazingly, no one in this room can forecast the future, right? And yet we're trying, but we'll be wrong. The only question is, are we going to be wrong a little bit, or are we going to be wrong a lot? And so the DOT decides they're going to build a second freeway, okay? What are you going to do about it? Well, now your plan doesn't make any sense. Since you would come back by years from now or whenever your next major update would be and say, these major inputs that we had expected to look like this are now going to look like this, and that changes what our plan is going to be. And in that process, you might change your comprehensive plan, you might change your transportation plan, you might therefore change the concurrency regulations that goes through that process. So the best way to handle the unknown of the future is to realize that you have to have some flexibility in the process. The good news about the planning, the planned approach to concurrency is you actually have an expectation of what that performance will be. And 5 years from now, if that performance isn't following the plan, now you can say, well, we'll make a major adjustment to the process. So it's the best way to handle that.
You don't know.
Right. You don't know the future, right?
Excuse me, sir. Okay, sir, I'm going to move on to another question. Thank you very much.
Okay. I was also just going to real quick add that it's probably updated. I think we probably look at updating things like with our two-year CIP cycle as well. Can I see how we're doing?
And CIP is?
Capital Improvement Program.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Like what projects we're going to build.
Okay, all right. So just for those in the audience, when you think, she's standing right next to me, why didn't she call on me? I'm going to try and move back and forth and be as fair as I can, so I'm going to come right over here.
Thank you. I agree with the approach to use multimodal analysis to make sure that all the trips are accommodated. But my concern is, I think we can predict the future because the past is a pretty good indication of it. How can we avoid the trap of trying to socially engineer people to behave in a way that they won't, and try and overemphasize certain modes and at the expense of those of how people will actually continue to behave? We've seen this where some jurisdictions have set high transit target rates that have never been met, but a disproportionate amount of their limited capital is being invested to try and achieve a goal that has failed. And now we're seeing some of those jurisdictions are reevaluating it, saying this is actually what the realistic mode splits will be, and we will make our capital investments into those based on that history and what we think is a reasonable projection for the future.
Yeah, I'll try responding to that. You know, we don't know exactly in the future, and transit's a good example, how many people will actually be taking transit to downtown Kirkland, or as Totem Lake develops as a regional center, how many people will be doing that. I think the approach that Dave described is to put a balanced set of investments that the city can control, and kind of set that as a target for the city. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you spend a bit more money on sidewalks that you're expecting everybody to stop driving their car and walk. It's to provide some choices and provide for some of those shorter trips. I think, you know, if in 5 years, 5 or 10 years from now, things change and the congestion gets really bad and nobody's riding the bus, and, you know, then I think the program has an opportunity to come back and say, well, maybe we need to make more of an investment in some of these other types of projects, and that's where the balancing comes in.
Let me add to that. One of the things, just repeating a plug that Dave had earlier about going downstairs, is the fact that we have multiple packages, and part of a process right now is to get the input from the community about where do we want to put that investment. Do we want to put all our money into roads and road capacity, for example, or do we want to, or how much emphasis do we want to put on walking and biking and other types of transportation? So, you know, within budget constraints, we have a fair amount of flexibility about where we allocate that money. So there's nothing set in stone. This is really about getting the community input to help us set those priorities.
I want to go two things just to add to that. One, when you say use the past, or do you want to use this part of the past, in which case the line goes this way, or do you want to use this part of the past, in which case the line goes that way? And the interesting aspect of that is, the question is, Kirkland has been this. If you look in the past, if you look in the 70s, this was Kirkland. So is Kirkland going to become this, or is Kirkland going to stay that? And my gut reaction is that there are parts of Kirkland that are going to be this, and there are parts of Kirkland that are going to be that. And you want to be careful that you don't apply these measures to these parts of Kirkland, but you don't want to apply these measures to those parts of Kirkland, which means you want to think very carefully about what your resources are in the different parts of Kirkland. I'll be quiet.
Penny? Marilyn Beard, assistant city manager, who's kind of organizing all this whole thing today, told me two things about today. She told me a lot of things, but two things about this morning. She said, don't be afraid to be provocative, and don't pile on answers after everybody's already talked. So I'm trying to balance those two things. I got to say this.
Yeah. Regardless of what Marilyn Beard said.
I think this whole thing about like social engineering is a little, sounds neat, but if you think about social engineering, you could look at the interstate system, which we think of, could we think of that as social engineering? So, you know, I think what we're really trying to do, I think Sandeep said it, is provide alternatives. We're not telling anybody you can't drive your car. What we're saying is if you wanted to walk to the grocery store, let's try to make that available. Thanks.
So, and those things are happening. Whether you like it or not, those things are happening.
Okay, why don't you leave that slide up? Okay.
So do you feel you have adequate capacity to model changes like the ones, for example, that he brought up or others, you know, kind of on the fly to play what ifs to determine where hotspots are and tune your program? Or do you feel you're inadequately funded in particular for that sort of modeling? I know we don't want to do this in a full-blown engineering manner, I guess, but I think there's some value to having an ability to model so that you can get a rational output on what your investment structure should be.
So the I guess I'll answer, it depends.
Good, yes.
The city does have a model that predicts primarily traffic volumes in the future based on the land uses that David indicated. And so we have a pretty good idea of, you know, if the land use is going to grow by a certain amount, we're going to get about this many more trips. What we can't predict reasonably is, for example, if 50% of the cars are automated vehicles in the future and everybody's able to drive, you know, 2 feet apart, that means we get a lot more use of our streets, and so therefore we get less congestion. I mean, we don't know that for sure. We are able to forecast, you know, they're proposing or planning to build on I-405 what they call express toll lanes, which would allow people to buy into what's now the HOV lanes and the adjacent lane. Well, how many people will that draw away from Kirkland City streets, which it intends to do? We're not sure. We can get a decent idea. Until some of these things actually start happening, you know, we'll be able to predict better probably 5 years from now what things are really going to look like as technology increases.
So first I wanted to say thank you for the very, like, interesting presentation. I was kind of wondering how you guys are going to approach the city of Kirkland, like, transportation, like, the youth. That's what I'm kind of curious about. Like, I think it's really important that young people have a voice in what the city is going to turn into and how it's going to change and develop. And I just kind of wondered, like, you can't really do that unless you educate the youth about how public planning works. Like, back when I was in high school and stuff,
so many years ago.
Yeah. You know, we just weren't really aware of how those things work, and we can only really use what's given to us. So I just want to know, like, how can the city and, like, the transportation and going forward with the, like, 2035 plan, like, how can you better inform, like, teenagers and young adults about their choices and how they can have their voice heard?
Well, I can talk about the youth member, and you talk about the so... Also, from a transportation commission point of view, we do actually have a student member on the commission who, Tess Pete, who is pretty active about providing input into transportation, and particularly from a youth and student perspective. So we have some of that input that comes as part of our day-to-day discussions and deliberations. And I'll let Dave talk a little bit more about outreach.
Yeah, I'm thinking that. I guess I was going to kind of ask, what do you think? And we have the City Youth Council, so we could maybe, I'm looking for somebody in the back who knows something about outreach, maybe take this show to them. I remember a few years back, I did a really interesting project with some high school kids. We used to have more of like a youth day, or and it was really interesting to talk to them about transportation and like what would get you to you know, not drive to high school, and it took a lot. I mean, it was more like, I don't know, could you just give me like more hours of sleep or something? You know, that's a great point. And so maybe we can talk afterwards. You tell me some ideas you might have.
So I think you're aware we experience in a lot of the Kirkland neighborhoods a lot of cut-through traffic of people trying to avoid 405. And I'm just wondering if there's any way that that's ever been measured. And I know that, obviously, Kirkland doesn't have a lot of influence over 405 or DOT, but, you know, is there anything going on to deal with that issue?
Well, I think the city, through the, you know, they do regular traffic counts and so forth, and they do monitor what's happening. It kind of varies from day to day, of course, depending on how bad things are on 405. The models I was talking about, you know, actually predict as best they can, you know, based on the speeds and congestion on 405, how many people would go on city streets. So I think we've got a reasonable handle on that. The challenge is going to be as they, for example, make further improvements on 405, how many people will actually get off the city streets and back onto 405, and then the effects of tolling and things like that. I think that's going to be a challenge over the next few years, just to make sure we have a good handle on that. Do you want to?
Well, I just wanted to maybe to two things that I've noticed. One I just saw last night was that we've been doing our crack traffic signal operations engineer Chuck Morrison, who just joined us earlier this year, or no, it's been here about a year. Sorry. Has been working at the intersection of 98th and 116th, you know, by Michaels. And he's made some, so far, you know, we'll see what it's like on 77 degrees on Thursday, how it responds when everybody's going to the park. But like last night I saw, wow, it's really different and better there. And I saw folks coming down 116th headed west. I mean, this is maybe in the weeds, but you turn, you can go on 100th and come back out kind of by Holy Spirit Lutheran Church there. And I was thinking, wow, those people, I bet they're kind of avoiding that signal, but look at it. It's really doing great. So I guess to say that some of the cut-through traffic, and we can also think about 108th Avenue north of Northeast 132nd Street, some of that is sort of due to congestion on surface streets as well. In Anna, your case, you're probably more of a 405 cut-through type of thing.
So I'm going to take another question back here, and then while I'm doing that, I'm going to ask you in the audience to think about something. And what I'd like you to think about is either yourself or your kids or your grandkids, and think about how they're going to be using the transportation system or you 20 years into the future. And might there be changes in the way people in Kirkland, particularly the younger folks, 20 years from now are using the system? So just kind of think about that, particularly in light of the chart that's up on the wall.
Okay. With the transportation problems, is there a capacity as to the number of apartments that are going to be okayed in the city? I've noticed using the Kirkland Park, the South Kirkland Park and Ride, I got all excited because they were enlarging it. And now you're still driving around. If you get there like 9:15, 9:30, you can't find a parking place, and then you see all these, you know, I call them stack and pack housing going in the park and ride. So you're trying to encourage us to use public transportation, but the park and ride is so condensed, it's discouraging. So it's almost like, you know, where are we going? You know, what's our capacity? What do you think as far as population explosion for the Kirkland area, where if that wasn't allowed to increase, if you weren't allowed to put all this multiple housing in here, maybe it would, you know.
Unfortunately, I can't answer the question. I mean, that's why you should be going downstairs and then joining in on this.
I was thinking of the Issaquah example.
So
if you didn't put the housing in South Kirkland Park and Ride, you could put it in Bothell, and then what would happen? I don't know.
But
my other thing is like, wouldn't it be awesome if you could take, you didn't have to go to the park
question.
And ride,
where's my,
and
where's Paul the might wrong direction.
Actually have a real answer.
One way you might answer the question is to the famous green slide, and that if you.
Okay, let him respond, though. Let him respond, please.
So, you know, I came here on the 255 from Seattle, right? I hopped on a bus, I made a change, and I came through. And the advantage of, the interesting aspect of that is there are parts to there down here. Whoops. There are parts in here because the 255 really comes right through the middle of the town. And yet there is an awful lot of parking in that area that you could take advantage of if you wish to. I have a son, one of my sons lives up in Mill Creek. On
164th.
Out on 164th, and all, you know, he is in Mill Creek. To get off 164th, it's an awful road, right? And lots of development going in. And the buses go straight up to the Ashway Park and Ride, drop off, and go home. And it takes 5 light cycles to get out of the Ashway Park and Ride lot to get onto 164th, and then fight your way down 164th. And I think, a little bit of work here. They've got must be 8 churches, none of which have any parking in them whatsoever during the vast majority of the day. I think, wow, you could reuse that parking space during the day. You've got parks. When do people need parking at parks? Well, they need parking at parks at 5 o'clock in the evening through 9 o'clock if they've got lights. It's later. You might be able to reuse parks there are other ways you could do in the manipulation of your system.
I think Paul might have a real answer.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of our challenge is we're trying to plan for growth over the next 20 years, and the question is, where should that occur? We're looking at places to be more walkable, more bikeable, more transit friendly, and how do you distribute that growth to the right places? So that's the question we're trying to deal with, and balance that transportation and land use so you can connect those things together so that people don't have to drive, but have options, as we talked about, and try to accommodate our so-called targets for housing and jobs that we're supposed to meet.
But are you really saying, like, it would be great to have more capacity at South Kirkland Park and Ride?
Kirkland is at capacity. I mean, it's starting to look like projects. You've got all these little apartments going in. I hear the apartments have been approved, but they don't have parking. You know, yeah, they say people don't need cars, but you've got one little QFC as a grocery store. How many people is that going to provide for?
Okay, Dave, why don't you take a quick well, answer to that, and then I'm going to move us on.
I mean, there is parking at the apartments.
Not
okay. Well, we can talk about it. We can talk about it. Paul, I think, between Paul and I, we can talk to you afterwards.
Sure.
We'll talk about that.
Okay. I had a question here. Do you have your hand up?
Quick question. How is all this going to be funded? Are they looking at ways of improving and stabilizing the funding? Tolls, property tax, gas tax, bonds? This is all going to be funded, but right now, it's an up-and-down process. How is it?
Yeah, so, like, again, downstairs, you can see some displays there about, like, where the money comes from. And we're kind of saying, all right, right now, our current assumption for downstairs is that there's about $8 million a year that would be available, kind of based on what's realistic from today, over the next 20 years to fund transportation.
Probably more stable.
Yeah, well, yeah, we feel like that's pretty stable, that number. If we went higher than that, it might be less.
And that's the city's funding. That doesn't speak to any other regional types of funding.
There's some grant funding included in there.
Right, but in terms of what DOT's funding is or Metro's funding, that doesn't speak to that.
Right.
You can only control the city's funding.
Right,
yeah. Okay, so I'm curious about my question. Are you thinking about 20 years into the future and your transportation? What do you think?
Well, I think with the youth, they would like to see the physical internet. And I thought, yeah, I heard Mark say something about the internet at the beginning of this, but that's the way transportation should go, like the internet. It never gets...
So it's going to grow more like the internet?
Yeah. Never gets congested.
The internet never gets congested. Oh, boy. Tell that to my computer. Yes, sir.
Understanding that auto demand for transportation will go down with these more recent trends... But still, we have the capacity problem is still related to the automobile. Now, what in your calculation of capacity to volume is being dismissed, or are you still using that to inform the list of projects?
We're still using it to inform the list of projects. Although if you go downstairs today, you won't see, like, if I chose this many dollars, what would my VOC ratio look like? But when we get a little farther along, Don, I think it's fair to say we could do something like that.
We're still looking at the, the traffic volumes and the congestion levels and the places where the city has identified where you need roadway improvements to those places where, you know, you're getting a lot more growth, and granted there's going to be more traffic, so it's just a little more targeted. One of the things that you'll find interesting down there is there's a board that talks about, well, what would it take to build our way out of congestion with roads? And other than, and it basically shows a lot of streets being widened, $500 million plus. And the question is, you know, I don't think anybody thinks that's reasonable to be able to do that. But then the question is, what is reasonable and feasible to do? So that's what we're trying to do in the master plan.
Ken, your question really gets to a question over here, which is like, well, how am I going to know what I'm getting? So we need to – and it's particularly important on the auto side, because on the other side, it's more about connectivity, like on bikes and peds. It's not really a capacity problem. It's a connectivity issue.
I think it is important, though. But bad news, and we should be, I think, transparent and clear, is we don't have a path that kind of eliminates congestion. Right? unless, magic leprechauns come and deliver very large pots of gold, there really isn't a plan that allows us to eliminate congestion. And I'm not sure you'd actually want the result. Even if we got those big pots of gold, it would fundamentally change the nature of a city. So really, this is a question more about what is the type of congestion that is going to result with the growth that is anticipated, and how much congestion can we live with, and where is that congestion really going to be?
That was your provocative statement. That was, yes.
Oh,
hopefully not a surprise.
I have the feeling that there is something I don't understand in this conversation, so probably because I must be quite ignorant. Everything seems to be very incremental. And like this lady was talking before me, things happen kind of pop around the city that you do not anticipate sometimes. And instead of, the way I would approach the whole conversation at the beginning would have been, okay, we're not thinking 20 years, we're thinking 100 or maybe 150 years. So you already indicated that you know what the growth is, so you think you know what's going to be, in the future. So if you take the whole city, wouldn't it make sense to say and have a conversation with the city is, okay, these are the areas that are going to be very dense. These are the areas where the growth is going to be. And once you decide that, then you kind of start talking about where is the best way to have the flow for cars. Many people, you have to accommodate different tastes. So some people like to be in dense areas, some people don't. And so once you have those, you concentrate the traffic in one area and then in the quiet area.
I think, and really, that's kind of the intent of the combination of the comprehensive plan and the transportation plan. They really are, in fact, looking at the land use side of these are the places where we will put pods, and these are the places where we are going to protect single-family housing and maintain it as single-family housing. And therefore, if this is the development, if this is what we're going to permit, this, in fact, are the transportation systems that we're going to get there. Then the incremental part is you have to build to it. The problem with thinking out 100 years is, if you go back 100 years, could you have predicted what Kirkland would have looked like? If 100 years ago, remember what Kirkland was. Kirkland was, about 100 years ago, it was probably about 20 houses on the lake. There is no I-90 bridge. There's almost nothing on the east side. It's farms and woods. And would you have predicted 100 years what it would look like? So 100 years is very hard for us to envision. We don't know whether automated cars will really be there. We can, however, envision 20 years, 40 years, 50 years. It's getting a little touchy there. On the comprehensive side, on the land use side, we can say this is what's permissible, and this is the transportation system that can serve it. So you're absolutely right there. You're not dumb at all. That's great, and that's really what the plan approach is trying to get at. If we allow growth to happen here, if we have so much we have to take, then we are willing to put pods in this location because we feel we can serve them. If we're not, then okay, then this goes away and we don't need that transportation system for this kind of land use. You really have to think of the two combined.
Does that help at all? I mean, I guess I would kind of go back to this and say, yeah, this is future land use based on zoning and redevelopment potential. So that's what we are doing, is trying to say where is the growth going to happen. But
okay, so I live in an area that has a lot of super blocks, and at one time the city had a vision to cut up these blocks and to have connectivity. But yeah, that seems to have gone by the wayside, because I have three new developments that are cul-de-sacs with no connectivity. And so how are we going to get to this vision that you have of the green slide when we don't maintain our planning vision and then zone appropriately so the results happen?
Yeah, good question. That's North Rose Hill, right? Yeah. And because it was my understanding Northwest Hill was one of the neighborhoods where we actually had laid out some connectivity. So I don't have an answer for you off the top of my head on that one, but we can talk to our development folks at Public Works if we can answer that. But you're absolutely right.
Okay. I have a couple comments and then a question. I lived in Kirkland since 1985, started in downtown, moved up to Bridal Trails, moved back downtown, went up to Finn Hill, and then I lived in Seattle for 5 years, and I just recently moved back to Kirkland. And what is really amazing to me is that Kirkland is so far ahead of Seattle. And when I left Kirkland 5 years ago, I was frustrated. But when I came back, I was so relieved. So my question is similar to the previous question, but I got into a discussion with a neighbor who was someone I had known 20 years ago. I now live up again in Bridal Trails. And they talked about one of these pod buildings being built at Tech City Bowl up on 132nd and 70th. And it immediately became a very heated discussion because I would prefer to see, as this woman said, the connectivity is better in Rose Hill than it, far better than it was in the past. But I would prefer to see this, you know, subdivision into mother-in-laws or smaller developments with smaller houses. And I don't know if that's been addressed because I missed your discussion, but I'm not sure why this, what I see on South Rose Hill is still really big houses, which is neither energy efficient, land efficient, or proactive, in my opinion. So I don't know, what are the policies on that and what are the plans? You can't take care of all future population growth, I understand, with that technique. But, you know, from what I'm seeing, that's one of the things I haven't seen, is more proactive approach towards smaller houses.
That sounds like a land use type of question.
We do have actually a toolbox kit that allows a variety of smaller units. We allow mother-in-law apartments or grandmother-in-law apartments, whatever you want to call them, in any residential zone. We allow smaller lots under certain conditions. They have to restrict the size of the house, and we have limits on the size of house in proportion to the lot size. So there are a number of things we have currently in play. I think as part of the plan update, we're talking about how do we continue that or have further conversation, how to make those work, how do we be more efficient in those type of operations, and what type of housing do we need for our kids, our college kids that are graduating, single-headed households, we're seeing a lot more of that. So part of this discussion on housing and land use and transportation is all related to those type of tools in our toolbox.
Hang on, I've got to get the mic back to you, but a very brief follow-up. I don't want to have time for others. Okay.
I just noticed that you're using the word allow, which means that there's not a consideration to me of regulations that actually more strongly encourage the builders who are doing this to change their ways.
Point noted.
Okay, so there was a comment made by one of the panelists a bit ago that said that congestion is happening and it's not going to go away, right? So I'm going to ask you to think about this. This is a question for you to think about individually, thinking about your transportation patterns, thinking about out over the next 20 years, what would you be willing to do to help reduce congestion, you personally, in your traffic patterns and your use patterns?
Yeah, I did. A lot of the discussion I've heard today is talking about land use patterns and management and how that relates to traffic that seems to be more focused on generated locally. And one of the things I see happening a bit is more some of the regional decisions that are happening that affect the local traffic patterns. And from a perspective of modeling or from funding, how is it that you are factoring in regional traffic decisions that are going on that affect our traffic loads here, whether it's more capacity or tolling on the bridge or diversions of traffic around the north end of Lake Washington into the city that didn't occur before? Are these factored into the models?
So the short answer is yes. The model includes SR 520 and the tolling, and includes the routes across the top of the lake. It includes what I mentioned about I-405 and so forth. We did a quick look, and you can examine it downstairs, of what happens if you didn't allow any more growth in Kirkland. We just sort of, and I guess not too surprising, a lot of the future volumes on the city streets are still going to be there because of people like Mark who drive in from Redmond, and we haven't put a toll booth on Redmond-Kirkland Road. Maybe we should. The 405 traffic is still going to be there. And so, there are certain things that we don't have control over, but we try as best we can to understand what the effects of things like putting tolls on 520 mean, as well as some of the other freeways.
Yeah, so we do have a board downstairs that talks a little bit about regional growth and regional volume.
Okay. Somebody new that hasn't had a question yet.
So you're planning, says we're gonna plan for 140% of the capacity of the road instead of 100. If you guys would say our sewer capacity is gonna overflow 40% of the time and our water is gonna run out 40% of the time, I don't think we'd have really good planning. Right. And so the more it just magnifies itself as it goes on. How'd you get to 140?
Yeah. Let's see. So 140 is like based on what's realistic to build. So it's kind of back to Don's thing. If you can go downstairs and see the board of like what it would take to get to, instead of 140, like 80 or 90 for cars. It costs a lot, and you have to widen a lot.
Wait, is this on? Okay, add one other thing to it, and that is the 140 is kind of a bizarre magic number in that we tend to model the peak period, right? And so the physical capacity of the road is the physical capacity of the road. You can't get any more on it than is what goes on it. So what happens is people change behavior. What they do is they leave earlier and they leave later. So 140, what that really means is you have a longer time period with which you have congestion. So if you look at roads economically, where our roads are terrible economic things because for 12-hour days, you don't use them. And you overuse them really badly for 3 hours, right? And so the 140, what it really is it's a cheap mathematical index that says this area is going to be congested for 4 hours instead of for 1 hour. And that's what it really means.
I think Mark came from Seattle, not Redmond. So if you're going to put the toll...
I've done the Redmond thing for 20 years, okay. So it's okay. He can blame me on that one.
My question is, I think we all think about change and how change... the notion of 100 years ago and the notion of 100 years from now, but change is always hard. I think some of the things that I see changing, and I'm hoping that we're promoting them, things like how are we going to get better transit here, because that's really important, not just bus or other things. And also the power, you probably talked about the internet. I heard somebody talk about that. What's the power of information in helping people manage and support their trip making? I think for all of us, we like having that information. When the road's congested, it lets us be more in control and have more decision-making power. So.
Can I respond to that first just in a couple of ways? One, I'm really aware of time, but I also have one bus away right now because one bus away tells me whether that bus is coming that I have to catch in order to make the game, right? 12:16, and I'll know whether it's early. Walking to my bus on the way here, it was a minute early, and I had to jog down the hill to get it. But I got it as a result of it. Information is really valuable, and people will use it because we are humans, and we change our behavior for our benefit. So providing information and options is good. I now live in Seattle, and one of the reasons I do is now I get to ride my bike to work, right? Because that was a choice that I made, right? Whereas living in Redmond and working at the U, the bike trip is not a pleasant commute. It's not an easy commute. People will take advantage of that as you change your opportunities. Some people will change. Some people will come here because they want to take advantage of those opportunities. So information about their options, providing options, allows people to make those choices. The interesting things you've got going on with the Cross Kirkland Corridor and the visions that you see on that picture over there, when you give people options, I think you will see the youth and people who are interested in it, of all ages, even old people like me, will take advantage of the cheap options, which are walking and biking. If you give them the options, they will. Do I still drive a car? Yes, I do. You still have to provide those options. But when you give a variety of options, including the information to help you use them, you will see a much broader characteristic take place. And you will attract people interested in those things, and the jobs, and the shops, and all the rest of it.
There's one more dimension about information. Definitely information is a very important part of changing people's behavior and making options accessible to them. We also look at information as a way of making the capacity that we have more efficient. One of the investments that we've been making for the last several years in the city is around something called Intelligent Transportation System, or ITS, which is really about using sensors and cameras and other technology in the road system itself to help us do things like time traffic lights, measure traffic, and actually adjust the road system itself based on how it's being used, the capacity demands. And so you find interesting ways to actually make the system more efficient by using technology as a data source.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the 1.4 factor. Just curious to see what is the average factor for a city like Kirkland in the U.S. And then I look at the example of Lake Washington Boulevard. I happen to walk, not driving, walk Lake Washington Boulevard around 4 to 6, depending on how things go. And very often I tag one car and I'm walking, not running. And I get to see downtown Kirkland from Carrion Point earlier
than
the
car.
So how does the 1.4 factor apply to Lake Washington Boulevard? And I know we are talking about 10 years, 20 years planning, but these are facts of today, because sometimes it's even impossible to walk because of the congestion, the fumes, and so on. So what are we doing to address that particular problem?
Well, I'll let these guys talk about what are they doing about it. But 1.4, again, is a fascinating number. If you get into traffic engineering, one of the factors that is true is that capacity is before the road breaks down. So if you look at a freeway carries 2,000 vehicles per lane per hour until it's congested. Once it's congested, it only carries about 1,400 vehicles per lane per hour. There are more vehicles there. They're stacked together, but they're not moving. And so one of the reasons you want ITS and to change signals to try to keep Lake Washington and other roads from breaking down is you actually serve more cars that way. Again, 1.4 is a mathematical number that comes from an averaging of a bunch of things, and I'll tell my average joke. You know the definition of an average?
No, what's
definition
that?
Of an average is if you take your left foot and stick it in a bucket of boiling water, take your right foot and stick it in a bucket of ice water, on average, you feel pretty good. So in roads either work or they don't work. And so our problem with 1.4 is what you're really trying to do is keep it from breaking. You want to spread that traffic out. And 1.4 tells you have a problem. Many, many arterials in this area have ratios of 1.4 in the modeling practice that show that they're broken. Most of the cities that are growing and trying to deal in metropolitan areas typically have roads in the modeling process that have that many intersections that are that far over congestion. It is not at all unusual.
Okay, we're going to do one more, and then we're going to finish it up.
What are you doing about Lake Washington?
So we don't have any plans to widen Lake Washington Boulevard or add auto capacity to Lake Washington Boulevard? I think what Sandeep said and what I said before him is we may still have that problem. But the interesting thing is, like, why do people keep driving that way?
Behavior. In other words, behavior might address the problem. Changing behaviors.
Well, I don't know. No, yeah. Well, I mean, we're not here to change behaviors. That just always occurs to me, like, I don't know, 1.4, 1.3, 0.89, I don't know. But people keep doing it. It's interesting.
Okay, let's finish up here with one more question, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Earlier, there was a line of questions about the lack of continuity and new development. If you put up the green slide again, I think Kirkland is on a microcosm perpetuating what's on the north side, these little cul-de-sac streets, in the way of half-acre to one-acre developments around a shared driveway that require then access to the main street. Why does Kirkland continue to allow that kind of development, Paul?
We had to ask one last question, right?
I think we are trying to promote connections, sometimes because of topography or because of right-of-way or because of the property ownership, it becomes difficult. But I think that the basic concept is to look for it where we can and make it work. So that's part of the discussion with our regs. We need to look at that again and see if we can do more about that. But we're really trying to make those connections and those type of situations work.
Just say one real quick thing. One of the reasons is to provide connections from that cul-de-sac might mean we need to connect into your street, and you don't want to connect into your street because it means they're going to drive by your house. That's the biggest challenge. It's one of the most charged topics politically in most cities is connections. So it's a tough one.
So
last words, Dave?
Yeah. Sandeep mentioned the magic leprechauns that might deliver pots of gold. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, the magic leprechauns have been here, but instead of pots of gold, they have pizza. So we have pizza for everyone downstairs.
Okay, excellent. Well, before we close out, let's thank our panel. Don Samdahl from Fairs and Piers. Sandeep Singhal, the chair of Kirkland's Transportation Commission. Mark Hallenbeck, the director of Washington State Transportation Center. Dave Godfrey, Kirkland's Transportation Engineering Manager. And, of course, last but not least, Paul from Planning. Thank you so much for participating.